Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The gift shop at the National September 11th Memorial Museum has sparked controversy. While museum administration says the shop will generate revenue to support the estimated $65 million annual operating costs, families of those killed and many others find it crass and insensitive. Among the keepsakes raising eyebrows and ire are an FDNY rescue dog vest for your pup, survivor tree earrings, a cheese plate in the shape of the U.S., and one item called a darkness hoodie. As offensive as it is to critics, the impulse to memorialize and perhaps profit has been part of the fabric of our culture since the American Revolution. Joining me now is Brady Carlson, host of All Things Considered on NHPR and our resident pop culture guru. He's currently traveling around the country while writing his book, Dead Presidents, An American Adventure. And the author, Brady Carlson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi there.
How far back do we go to find people using tragedy as an opportunity to hawk wares?
Well, as far back as there's been tragedy and as far back as there's been wares, honestly. I mean, you think of funerary art, art representing death or remembrance. I mean, that goes back into ancient times. And it's not really a huge stretch, I suppose, for someone to decide that they could make a few dollars by selling their funerary art. In early America, there was a very popular series of products based on a picture called The Apotheosis of Washington. It's basically showing George Washington after death being welcomed into heaven by a group of angels. And you'd find this on prints and on water jugs and all over the place, not to mention black ribbons or memorial medals and coins. I mean, the list goes on and on. And it's really kind of stayed that way ever since.
Other funerary trinkets of American presidents come to mind?
Probably my favorite is one that I saw at the tomb of James A. Garfield, who was our 20th president and the second one to be assassinated. This wasn't really a memorial item. It was put out, I think, in the 1920s or 30s, but it was by a company called the Garfield Tea Company of Brooklyn. He's from Ohio. But it was a laxative tea. So they have this incredibly disturbing slogan called Flush Your Bowels with Garfield Tea. And what exactly this was intended to do, I'm not entirely sure, but it was probably one of those cases where here's a very well-known figure. Here's a chance to sell some products. We put the two together and off we go.
Location. Well, even at the site of the World Trade Center, while the buildings were still smoldering, people were selling American flags and Statue of Liberty hats, and people were taking photos of themselves with buildings in the background. What is behind this impulse to be in that place, to acknowledge that you were there?
I think that's really what it is. We like souvenirs, frankly, and so we like to have something that we can hold in our hands or something that we can display at home to remind us of a particular experience that we had, whether it was being part of a major news event, good or bad, or something that has personal resonance, or simply something that we experienced, like going through a museum. That's why they all have gift shops, because people do buy things. They like to have something they can take with them. And there's a term that I heard in particular with the 9/11 Museum. I read it in Maclean's, and the writer Ann Kingston called it catharsis consumerism, that buying things is one of the primary ways that we commemorate major events. And there's a cultural component to it as well. And you think of what happened in the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombings. The Boston Strong t-shirts were initially put together as a way to raise money for the fund for the victims. But on top of that, it became a way for this group of people, the city or the community of the greater Boston area, to sort of cope with this horrific event, and also a way that people could participate and take part in.
It's a common cause.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, all right, let's look at Gettysburg. 50,000 people killed. Yet it's like this living museum. There are people wandering around there with costumes and loads of items in the gift shop that one might find questionable. What are some of the things that are on offer?
Well, I mean, it's worth pointing out that Gettysburg, by the way, is, aside from the official gift shop and the official battlefield itself, is this sprawling tourism place, not even just in the actual Gettysburg area, just driving in or out on either direction, you'll find tourism-related stuff everywhere. Nothing attracts an entrepreneur like a crowd, I guess. But you will find everything from a Robert E. Lee Nutcracker. What is it, $200, I think?
$200 for that. But we should note that the regular troop member waving a flag is $109, and the colored troop member, $99.99.
Wow, rank has its privileges, among other things. But there are Civil War officer costumes for kids. I remember seeing play money, lots of historical toys, the kinds of things that 19th century kids might have played with. And then there are T-shirts that, with slogans of all manner of tastes, like no rifles, no swords, just balls. it really is a case of when you get that many people coming, and thousands of people come to Gettysburg every year, you get people who are coming for a lot of different reasons. Some are very interested in the history, and they're very emotionally connected to the people and the events of those days. And then you have other people who sort of vaguely remember the name Gettysburg and think it's kind of cool to have been in some place where something important happened, and why not do a little shopping while you're there?
How about the World War II Museum now? Let's put this in perspective compared to Gettysburg. Battle deaths, 15 million. Civilian deaths, 45 million. A long time in the making. What can you buy there to commemorate this historic event?
Well, you could play World War II Monopoly. You could have all manner of military vehicles take the place of the thimble or the dog or the wheelbarrow. There's a D-Day lighter gift set. There are GI helmets for kids. I've seen museums where you can buy military-style rations of every kind. And good eating, right?
And lucky strikes.
Exactly.
Well, the Monopoly game, I just want to read a little bit of the description. Honor, courage, victory. Honor the brave men and women who face the global spread of tyranny when you play America's We're All in This Together, a World War II edition of America's favorite game, Monopoly. So, you know, I guess a part of it, the tackiness may come in the merchandising and in this case, the copywriting.
And sometimes the intent can be different from the outcome. I mean, I always grew up thinking G.I. Joe dolls were kind of a crass cash-in on very honorable people serving the country. And yet, we heard this week when the creator of G.I. Joe dolls passed away, you heard his story, and he said, this is a way that we can bring into popular culture, a way to remember that there are people in the world who are trying to protect us every day, that they are serving and willing to risk their lives to do that. And that kind of turned my head around about that. I had no idea that that was the actual impetus behind G.I. Joe.
I'm joined by NHPR's Brady Carlson, and we're talking about the controversy surrounding the gift shop at the 9/11 Memorial Museum in New York City. It turns out that tone-deaf keepsakes have been a part of American history for a long time. But I guess the other decider here is when is it too soon? Not a lot of time has passed since September 11th. 13 years, it's still vivid in the memory of many people, unlike Gettysburg or Pearl Harbor, for example.
And I would bet that changes what you would see in a gift shop. Had there been a Gettysburg gift shop 10 years after the battle in 1873, you wouldn't have found some of those nutcrackers or the playing cards or the Abraham Lincoln Growler Kids Buzzsaw that you might find in some of these shops in the Gettysburg area today.
Let me just mention how freaked out we were about the buzzsaw. I mean, what did they use
the
buzzsaw for in the Civil War? It's just not a good picture. But, you know, okay, yeah, Gettysburg does feel like ancient history to us. But, of course, kids who weren't born on September 11th or were grade school kids are going to be finding out about what happened there in a very, very different way. I guess this is the churn of history in the same way that I look at stuff at the World War II Museum and find, you know, Hawaiian shirts with bombers on them to be of questionable taste.
And I think that people who have emotional connections to these events are going to look at them differently than people who were born afterwards and are having a much more intellectual conversation about it. There is an argument being made, and it's always made, that really what you're doing, yes, you're buying a trinket, but you are, in a way, supporting this museum and you are supporting an effort to try and tell the story of this museum. And you can go back and forth on that. But what you likely will find is that the museums will end up with more revenue with a gift shop selling some of these questionable items.
And people clearly buy them.
And people, well, we'll see about the cheese plate, but these items would not end up on the shelves if people didn't buy them.
It's not just the passage of time, but of course it's how we communicate. This is something you and I have spoken about a lot. The Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum, now this was commemorating the most similar event to 9/11 in recent history because it was an attack on U.S. soil. One article that I read, there were no cries of anguish when the Oklahoma City Museum's gift shop opened. But it was also noted that this was pre-internet and social media days. So maybe people just weren't weighing in?
That's a really interesting question, because if you walk through a gift shop, you're walking through kind of as yourself. You're not necessarily broadcasting to the world that you find the fact that they have one particular trinket or other to be offensive or in poor taste. Whereas now you can, and if one person happens to have their opinion catch fire and several tens of thousands of other people start to have the same reaction and say, wait a minute, I don't think that's okay, then you might have a much bigger question, a much bigger debate on your hands. For what it's worth, the items that I saw on the online shop for the Oklahoma City Memorial were pretty low key. There were no cheese plates that I could find.
There was the one rescue dog.
There was the little rescue dog plush toy, which outside of the context is absolutely adorable.
Well, lest I sound like I'm completely against this, when I went to the Holocaust Museum in Berlin, it was such a moving experience that I picked up something. You know, it was a postcard, but it was just a photograph of something or somebody that I wanted to remember. So I don't by any means want to come off as, you know, boy, this is a tacky, horrible thing to do. Gift shops are just a part of the thing. But is this a particularly American thing, do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, we certainly do tend to lead the way on these kinds of trinkets. This is a society that prides itself on its entrepreneurial spirit and participation. Then again, there are, as you said, there are gift shops at the Anne Frank House. There are gift shops at Holocaust museums all over the world. There are gift shops at the Hiroshima Monument in Japan. So there's just something very human, boundaries aside, about finding a way physically and maybe virtually going forward of saying, I was here, this meant something to me, and I want a way to keep that tangible as I go forward and go on with the rest of my life.
Well, Memorial Day was this past weekend, and many people, you know, head to the beach or the barbecue, long weekend. And there's a lot of criticism about that, that we're forgetting the essential meaning of Memorial Day. Do you think that will eventually be the same with 9/11?
It's certainly possible. I mean, you've seen, I think what you've seen is that at least in this first generation, when those of us who remember it very vividly are still here and still part of that debate about the meaning of the day and how it should be commemorated, the core memory of the day is still there. But you're already starting to see it evolve here, even in this first generation, with people who are still around and still remember it very vividly. You see the National Day of Service, and you start to see these debates about, well, in an election year, is it appropriate for candidates to campaign on September the 11th, or is it not? And that debate is going to continue going forward. But with Memorial Day, what you've seen is the core meaning is still there, but there are these other meanings that have been hung on there as well. And a lot of that is due to the economic impulse that's always part of culture. Tourism organizations who say, this is really a perfect way to kick off summer. It's an event that we're all familiar with. It's an event that we all in some way participate in. And so we will, whether or not they intend to take away from that actual meaning of Memorial Day or not, it adds this other layer of meaning on top. And so the day tends to evolve rather than completely change in one direction or another.
Well, Brady, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you.
Brady Carlson is host of All Things Considered here on NHPR. He's also our resident pop culture guru until we come up with another name. He's in the midst of writing a book called Dead Presidents, An American Adventure. And we have compiled a slideshow of some of the most tone-deaf historical keepsakes that we could find. That's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Donald Levine created G.I. Joe to honor the U.S. Armed Forces, but his action figure is not the only toy inspired by significant moments and people in U.S. history. When Word of Mouth continues, the historical origins of the teddy bear and its not-so-successful successor, the Billy Possum. That story after the break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last Thursday, Donald Levine, a Korean War veteran and the father of the G.I. Joe, passed away. He developed the iconic action figure in part in tribute to veterans. And the G.I. Joe is not the only beloved toy rooted in American history. Roman Mars of 99% Invisible and producer John Millwillam bring us this story of the teddy bear and its not nearly as successful younger brother, the Billy Possum.
This is the tale of two toys with two very different fates.
I'm John Mwalem. I'm a writer with the New York Times Magazine.
Our tale starts in 1902.
Theodore Roosevelt is president.
And he decides to vacation in a town called Smeads in the Mississippi woods, where he can hunt black bear.
He's a big outdoorsman, big hunter.
And this hunting trip became kind of a famous story.
He had spent a few days hunting, and I don't think they even saw a single bear. They definitely didn't get to shoot at any.
Finally, the dogs get the scent of a bear, and the guide goes ahead while the president hangs back. The guide says,
"You just stay here, and I'll flush it right to you."
The hunting party finds the bear, knocks it on the head, and ties the semi-conscious creature to a tree
so that the president can be the one who has the honor of shooting it.
But there had been a drought that year, and the captured bear was mangy and about half its normal size. And Roosevelt takes pity on it.
He decides that it's unsportsmanlike to shoot this thing. You know, he's not going to do it, and he doesn't want anyone else to do it either. You know, word of this spreads, and a political cartoonist draws a cartoon of the moment of him showing the bear this mercy. And the way the cartoonist draws the bear is almost like a little Labrador puppy or a golden retriever puppy. It's sort of on its butt and its hind legs, and it's got these big, round, perked up ears, almost like Mickey Mouse, and these big wide eyes, and it's staring at the president, waiting to see what its fate will be.
And they called it Teddy's Bear.
This adorable little bear in the cartoon was turned into a three-dimensional plush toy.
And it was a sensation, but it was also weird. At its height, the teddy bear completely overshadowed even baby dolls, of all things. But the toy industry thought it was just a novelty, and as soon as Roosevelt left office, the reign of the teddy bear would be over.
So it was really looking for whatever was going to be the next cuddly plaything that American kids were going to want.
So fast forward to 1909, and Roosevelt's term is about up, and the president-elect is Roosevelt's hand-picked successor, William Howard Taft.
And that January 1909, Taft is in Atlanta. He's trying to woo the South, and he's the guest of honor at this banquet.
And the Chamber of Commerce in Atlanta decides it's going to serve him the truest, most unpretentious Southern dish around. The meal was possum and taters.
And a possum would be roasted on a bed of sweet potatoes and then presented whole on a platter with its head on, its tail on. Often you'd get a smaller little sweet potato crammed between the animal's teeth. The one that they brought to Taft's table weighed 18 pounds. All of a sudden, the orchestra strikes up and the guests burst into song. Suddenly, Taft is presented with this surprise gift, and it's a small, stuffed opossum toy.
And this is a brand new invention that some local Taft supporters are trying to position as William Taft's presidency's answer to the teddy bear.
They're calling it the Billy Possum. Already, there was a company set up called the Georgia Billy Possum Company. According to one account, within 24 hours of that banquet, there were already deals being brokered for Billy Possums with distributors across the country.
But since you probably never heard of a Billy Possum, you can guess what comes next.
It was a total flop, and the Billy Possum was forgotten and almost entirely out of stores within a couple of months. The Billy Possum never even made it to see Christmas time, which is a special kind of tragedy for a toy.
John Willem thinks it's these different origin stories that explain a lot of why the teddy bear was so huge and the Billy Possum was such a failure. The teddy bear story and the famous cartoon made bears into cute little companions. Taft ate his 18-pound possum at a banquet. Taft even bragged about how much possum he consumed.
"Well, I like a possum, and I ate very heartily of it last night, and it did not disturb in the slightest my digestion or my sleep."
That image does not make for a good toy. Not like Teddy's cute little bear. Also, much like that possum eating story, opossums are kind of creepy. By the way, the black bear that inspired the teddy bear, the truth is the hunting party totally ate that poor thing. They're bear hunters.
And on the last night of their trip, they finished it off. They roasted its paws, and I kid you not, they ate the paws with a side of possum and taters.
That story from Roman Mars of 99% Invisible and producer John Milwellum. You can find a link to hear it again on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Oh, baby, then you let me be your loving teddy bear. Put a chain around my neck and lead me anywhere. Let me be,
oh, let him be.
When Word of Mouth continues after the break, we're going to look into another relic of the past, handwritten correspondence, and what these unguarded relics of the past reveal. We're going to open the mailbag with the founder of the popular Letters of Note blog after the news.
Oh, teddy bear. Oh, let me be.
Oh, let him be your teddy bear.
I just want to be your teddy bear.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On May 19th of 1964, William P. McFarland, then product marketing manager for the Campbell Soup Company, sent a typed letter to artist Andy Warhol. The letter reads, "Dear Mr. Warhol, I have followed your career for some time. Your work has evoked a great deal of interest here at Campbell Soup Company for obvious reasons. At one time, I had hoped to be able to acquire one of your Campbell Soup label paintings, but I am afraid you have gotten much too expensive for me." The letter, which was accompanied by several cases of Campbell's tomato soup, is one of dozens featured in the new, perfectly titled coffee table volume, Letters of Note, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. Also featured are letters by Charles Darwin, Mick Jagger, Ludwig von Beethoven, Elvis Presley, Benjamin Franklin, and many, many more than we have time to mention. All of them lovingly reproduced, complete with the original smudges, creases, and ink stains. The collection was compiled by Sean Usher, who joins us now. Hello, Sean.
Hello.
Now, before we dive into some of the details, do you have one or two favorite letters that you think best represents this collection?
It's like choosing a favorite child.
but I guess you can't do that.
I try not to. I do have a favorite job application letter. Oh. I used to be a copywriter when I first started this project.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because there are parallels. It's a letter written by Robert Pirosh, who at the time, many years ago, was a copywriter who wanted to become a screenwriter in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote a job application letter and sent it to all the Hollywood producers and directors he could find addresses for. It's a beautiful standard form job application letter, and it netted him an interview with quite a few movie studios, one of which was MGM, and it got him a job with MGM, and he went on to win an Oscar for his Battlefield script with Groucho Marx. But the letter itself is just the perfect application letter. It's like essentially him listing all his favourite words, and then at the end saying, I mean, they're beautiful, beautiful words. It's a lovely letter to read. And at the end of it, he says, "I still like words. Can I have a few with you?" And that one just resonated with me.
So that got you started. What was it about this communication between two people that's kind of intimate? You know, you weren't meant to read that letter. That got you started.
Well, I used to work as a copywriter, as I said, and the reason I got into it was one of my clients was a stationery retailer, so they had stationery shops. I needed to write an interesting article for them for their website. The only thing, kind of tenuous link I could think of, this was after writing many, many articles for them over the years, was famous letters. So I went to the local library, had a look at all these dusty old books full of these amazing letters from people like Mark Twain, and was instantly hooked and spent the next couple of days just with my head buried in these books. I went to the local museum and I was just blown away. And I thought, rather than, you know, write a single article about these letters, I should maybe start a blog. Literally within something like 3 days, I had the website up and running, and it took off really quickly.
And some of them must be priceless. A lot of from historical figures, Mary Stuart writing to her sister about being, she's about to be executed. A letter from Jack the Ripper, sort of taunting the official who's after him. Are they priceless? Can you just copy them?
Oh, some of them do. It depends on their age. Sometimes, you know, if they're over a certain amount of years old, depending on the country in which they exist, then they're free to use their public domain. But a lot of them aren't in public domain. So I've spent the last 4 years contacting literally hundreds of people to get their permission to reprint these letters. But as you were talking about priceless, there's a letter in there from Francis Crick, who co-discovered the structure of DNA. Mm-hmm. And just after he discovered the structure, before alerting the public, he wrote an amazing letter to his son.
March 19th, 1953. My dear Michael, Jim Watson and I have probably made a most important discovery. We have built a model for the structure of deoxyribonucleic acid. Read it carefully. Called DNA for short. You may remember that the genes of the chromosomes, which carry the hereditary factor...
It's just the most incredible letter, you know, a hugely important, historically important letter. And it went up for sale last year at Christie's Auction House, and it sold for something like £5 million, and it's
Whoa.
The most expensive letter ever sold at auction.
We think we have found the basic copying mechanism by which life comes from life. You can understand that we are very excited. Read this carefully so you understand it. When you come home, we'll show you the model. Lots of love, Daddy.
There's an element here of secret history, you know, these small, important, mm-hmm. emotional details that get left out of official history books. I'm thinking of the letter from the freed slave Jernan Anderson to his former master, or from the British explorer Robert Scott, who on an expedition to the South Pole gone terribly wrong wrote a letter to his wife, which he addressed to my widow. Is that what you're seeking out? These
That's
kind
exactly
of drama?
What I'm seeking out, yeah. Yeah, if a letter moves me and brings me close to tears, then I'll put it on the website and maybe in the book. But it is those really kind of emotional moments that I'm looking for. They really are first person kind of views of historical events that much of the time. And it's far more interesting and accessible way to learn about these historical moments, to read these first person accounts.
Yeah, because you're getting a glimpse into something that has a sender and a recipient in mind.
Indeed.
You know, what is it about letters that let us in a way that other, even novels don't necessarily?
When you sit down to write a letter, well, for me anyway, when I sit down to write a letter, I'm in a completely different frame of mind than when I send an email or a Facebook message or a tweet to someone. I really open up. I'm far more focused on the job at hand. I'm willing to talk about things I wouldn't want to talk about by email for some reason. I think it's more about the focus. When I'm writing an email to someone, I've usually got a few tabs open on the computer and I'm flicking backwards and forwards, and it takes me, you know, a couple of hours to write a long email. But when you're sitting down to the typewriter and you're writing a letter to someone, you have to be so focused to get it right, you know, just to physically get the letter right, that it really puts you in a different frame of mind, and it's a far more considered form of communication. And that's what we are slowly, well, quickly now, losing, just for the sake of brevity.
Any examples of something that has an emotional resonance that just stuck with you?
Yeah, there's one that always gets me, and it's from an quite a surprising source. It's from Iggy Pop, to a young fan. Have you read this one?
I don't know. You know, that's the one thing about this book. You dip in and out, but I still haven't read them all.
Right. Well, 3 years ago, a lady wrote to me and she said, I was once sent a letter by Iggy Pop. Would you like to see it? And I said, yeah, of course I would. And she sent me this letter. And when she was 15, back in 1995, she was having a terrible time. Her parents were splitting up. There were bailiffs on the doorstep. She didn't know where to turn. She was getting depressed. And she was a huge fan of Iggy Pop's. And on his latest album, on the inlay, he printed his address with a little note saying, you know, if you want to get in touch with me, just write me a letter and I'll get back to as many as I can. So she wrote to him, told him about her troubles and her terrible family life. And he wrote back this really lovely, generous, very, very personal handwritten letter to her in this kind of scrawled handwriting, which gives it just so much charm. And it was just the most beautiful letter. And it really changed her life. And she said it really kind of put me on the straight and narrow from that point. And it saved me. Shall I read some of that out?
Yes, but keep in mind that you can't swear on...
I was going to miss that out, yeah. okay, well, it goes like this. It's quite a brief letter. So it says, "Dear Lawrence, thank you for your gorgeous and charming letter. You brighten up my dim life. I read the whole thing, dear, of course. I'd love to see you in your black dress and your white socks too. But most of all, I want to see you take a deep breath and do whatever you must to survive and find something to be that you can love. You're obviously a bright chick with a big heart too. And I want to wish you a belated, happy, happy, happy 21st birthday and happy spirit. I was very miserable and fighting hard on my 21st birthday too. People booed me on the stage and I was staying in someone's house and I was scared. It's been a long road since then, but pressure never ends in this life. Perforation problems, by the way, means to me also the holes that will always exist in any story we try to make of our lives. So hang on, my love, and grow big and strong and take your hits and keep going. All my love to a really beautiful girl. That's you, Lawrence. Iggy Pop."
Oh, Iggy Pop.
It's amazing. I never thought he was a bad person, but to see that, to see the amount of effort he went to get this letter to a troubled young fan, it just really blew me away, and that's really, really stuck with me.
And I'm looking at it now in the book, and you reproduced it. It looks like it's torn out of a, you know, sort of wire-bound notebook.
Yeah. Which just gives it even more charm. You know, if it had been typed out really neatly, I don't think it would have been quite as impressive.
I am a passenger, and I ride.
I'm speaking with Sean Usher. He's curator of the blog Letters of Note, where he collects a diverse selection of letters to and from famous and unknown individuals. He recently compiled a collection of correspondence into a beautiful volume, also called Letters of Note. Well, let's talk about penmanship, because I see his, which sounds, you know, it sort of like begins a little stiff and then just sprawls out. Often we know so much about these historical figures in the collection. I'm thinking of Benjamin Franklin or Queen Elizabeth II, and yet sometimes seeing their handwriting adds something to the perception of them. Anybody whose handwriting really surprised you?
Mark Twain's, but then there's a letter in there that he wrote to a bogus medicine salesman. And he wrote this letter basically telling him to get lost because he'd lost his son and his daughter and his wife. So this medicine salesman wrote to him and said, I can, you know, cure all your problems with this magical elixir. So Mark Twain was furious, and he handwrote this draft of a letter that's in the book, and you can see his handwriting. And you can see he was furious because the letters are just kind of flying off the page. And he basically, as I said, told him to get lost. I love it when you can see the emotion in people's handwriting. The Queen's was quite surprising. I always expected the Queen's writing to be incredibly neat and elegant, but it isn't. I don't know why I thought that. Well, just because it's the Queen, I suppose.
She's giving the recipe for drop scones to President Dwight David Eisenhower, as promised.
So Eisenhower had been to Balmoral and stayed with the Queen, with his wife. And the Queen, apparently, I hope this is true, had... made him some drop scones, her own personal recipe, and he loved them so much that he asked for the recipe. And then a few months later, she finally sent it. So you can see the handwritten letter, and you can see the actual recipe that was sent.
Which also notes that you have to beat them pretty vigorously, and I'm just trying to imagine the Queen vigorously beating batter.
It's a lovely thought, isn't it? You wouldn't get that anywhere else. And I actually wrote, because it's the first letter in the book, so just before the launch of the book, the launch party, I wrote to the Queen and I said, "This, you know, your drop scone letter is a real gem, and it's such a great way to open the book. I'd love you to come to the launch party. Would you like to come? Maybe we could clear some space and you could have a table where you could make these drop scones and present them to everyone." And she didn't write back to me personally, but the lady in waiting did and said the Queen's busy that day. She said she wishes you the best with your book and hopes you have a lovely launch party. But that was on Buckingham Palace letterhead. That was a lovely letter.
There are a number of bureaucratic misses in the collection. So have you benefited from many governments' habits of archiving everything in triplicate?
Yes, thank goodness. Yeah, there must be about a fifth of the letters in there are from National Archives. Mm-hmm. There's a memo written, it's a really chilling memo written to Nixon's chief of staff by a speechwriter, in which he writes a speech to be read out by Nixon should Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin not return from the moon. Mm. And it's this, it really is a bone-chilling speech that would have been read out. And then afterwards there's instructions to contact the widows-to-be.
To H.R. Haldeman, from Bill Sapphire, July 18, 1969. In event of moon disaster, fate has ordained that the men who went to the moon to explore in peace will stay on the moon to rest in peace. These brave men, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin, know that there is no hope for their recovery. But they also know that there is hope for mankind in their sacrifice. These two men are laying down their lives in mankind's most noble goal, the search for truth and understanding. They will be mourned by their families and friends. They will be mourned by their nation. They will be mourned by the people of the world. They will be mourned by a Mother Earth that dared send two of her sons into the unknown. Prior to the president's statement, the president should telephone each of the widows-to-be. After the president's statement, at the point when NASA ends communication with the men, a clergyman should adopt the same procedure as a burial at sea, commending their souls to the deepest of the deep, concluding with the Lord's Prayer.
One of the things that I did notice was that letters can connect ordinary people with historical giants that normally seem so out of reach, you know, between children and artists who inspire mm-hmm. them. Or in one funny case, an exchange between a little boy and the architect Frank Lloyd Wright. What can you tell us about that one?
Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, one of the great, I think he was voted the greatest ever architect in history. He designed a house for a rich family in America. And then the little boy, years and years later, decided that he wanted a doghouse designed in the same style as the house for his beloved dog. So he wrote to Frank Lloyd Wright and said, you know, please could you... It was a beautiful handwritten letter by this little kid. Please could you design a house for my dog to match our lovely house that you designed. Frank Lloyd Wright, who must have been one of the busiest architects on earth, wrote back and said, you know, I'm a bit busy at the moment, but, you know, write again in a few months. So the little boy did. He wrote back. And then Frank Lloyd Wright agreed to it. So in the book, you can see the first letter and Frank Lloyd Wright's reply. And then there's some plans that he made for the doghouse. And there's a photo of the eventual doghouse. And it's just the most lovely exchange. The sting in the tail is that the dog hated the house when it was eventually built. So
he would not be the only inhabitant of a Frank Lloyd Wright house.
He may not have
liked it.
He slept outside the doghouse.
I love that the kid says he's 4 years old, or in dog, 28 years.
Yes. It's just such a lovely story.
Well, okay, so you've opened up this whole world of wonder and charm and sort of intimacy between people. What else do you see in these letters that you don't find in an email or a text message or a tweet?
It's the physicality as well, being able to look at someone's handwriting, you know, the style of paper they've chosen. Even that interests me, looking at the letterhead, looking at the envelope, even the postmark. There's so much to, just as a visual thing, as a visual object, there's so much to be excited by a letter. As soon as a letter comes through the postbox and it's not a bill, as soon as it hits the doormat, I'm kind of excited already. Mm. And then you open it and it's just kind of knowing that someone's gone to the effort to write this letter for you. Just, again, it puts you in a different frame of mind than when you just, you know, click on your inbox on Gmail.
Sean Usher, what a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much.
Sean Usher curated the new volume, Letters of Note, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. Now, we do have a link to the blog that began it all, where you can see some of the letters that we talked about here and many, many more. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter.
Handwritten letters are not the only thing to fall victim to the digital age. The typewriter is now an endangered species. When Word of Mouth continues, the story of a poet with a typewriter and a simple business model. Name a price, pick a subject, get a poem. That's after the break. This is NHPR. Aspiring writers are familiar with sending their work out in hopes of getting published, but they often face quite a bit of rejection. One Lancaster, Pennsylvania native and poet decided not to follow that model. She writes and sells her work all within 10 minutes, several times a day. WITF arts reporter Joe Ulrich spent some time with her as she worked.
On a sunny April morning just outside of Lancaster Central Market, there are sounds of traffic, people making their way to and from the market, a man playing guitar, and this sound. A typewriter. At a small table about the size of a TV dinner table sits a woman in her early 20s. Leaning up against the front of the table is a sign that says,
"Name a price, pick a subject, get a poem."
Abigail Mott, or Abby, is her name.
So people walk up to me and give me a topic and I write for them.
Abby is from Lancaster originally, but she now resides in Denver, Colorado. She's back in Lancaster for a trip, and she's set up here at Lancaster Central Market to write and make a bit of money. Street musicians aren't that unusual, but Abby's street art kind of stands out a bit.
I think it has a lot to do with the typewriter. I think most people just think it's a really cool idea. They like the spontaneity of it, and yeah, the spontaneity and creativity of what I'm doing.
We don't get to chat long before another customer walks up.
Hi.
Hi.
How about Paris for $5?
Okay.
Does that sound good?
Yeah, that sounds great. Tell me, I've never been to Paris. It's on my list. What's your impression of it?
After getting a fresh sheet of paper, Abby occasionally asks a question to get a little more context for the poem. Then she goes silent. Her hands tentatively touch the keys. She looks around. She looks down. She's taking the information she's been given, and she's arranging it in her head. The typing comes in spurts. It's obvious that this isn't just a job for Abby.
I would call it a way of life. And I was in San Francisco 2.5, 3 years ago, walking down Haight Street and saw a guy under the Haight-Ashbury sign doing this. And he and I had a conversation. He wrote me a poem. And through our conversation, we talked about writing and how one creates so spontaneously. And he had an extra typewriter at his apartment and told me to come over the next day and he would lend me a typewriter until I could afford my own.
And that's how she found the way to not be at the mercy of a publisher.
I deal with way less rejection slips doing this. Way more positive feedback.
Sort of, I'd say Abby is controlling the marketplace as well as the production.
That's Barrett Rudick, an independent filmmaker from Portland, Oregon.
There's no middle ground of, you know, publishing houses or even editors, really.
Barrett is from Portland, Oregon, and is an independent filmmaker. He met Abby when she was there writing some poetry. He got Abby to agree to have a film made about her and her work. It's called A Place of Truth. Before I left, I asked if she'd write a poem for me. I asked her to write something about public radio, news, and truth. Barrett and I chat a bit while Abby taps something out. And when she's done, she reads it to me.
Okay, here we go. Radio truth. The truth is in the edits. What to cut and glue together? Where is the portrait mirroring reality as it falls to shadow? Radio has no puppeteer pulling wooden face strings. No financier drilling into the eyes stuck on a scrolling screen. The truth is in the pantry, and for those brave enough to open it and see which skeleton falls out.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Oh, that's awesome.
For the WITF Arts and Culture Desk, I'm Joe Ulrich.
Typewriter, tip, 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 karta hai. Zindagi ki har kahani likhta hai.
Typewriter, tip, 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 karta hai.
Thank you for your listening time today. The show may be over, but the conversation continues on our Facebook page. Earlier, we spoke to the founder of Letters of Note about the power of handwritten correspondence. And we'd like to know, does anyone out there still write letters? Does anyone have a pen pal? If so, please tell us. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.